The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Congress moves to close the deal today, Wednesday, October 16th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Both houses of Congress are now expected to approve a deal that ends the shutdown and lifts the debt ceiling, but has lasting damage to America's image already been done? We take the pulse of Americans around the world, starting with this stand-up comedian in China.
Chinese people always ask me, like, in America, can you make jokes about the government? And I say that actually, no, you can't, because the government itself is a joke.
We'll also get the view from Mexico on our fiscal mess, but the real news south of the border today, Mexico's ongoing soccer woes.
A lot of people here are saying, you know, more than talking about the default, they're saying things like they don't even want to see their team in Brazil because it would be just too embarrassing.
Plus, the cronut hits London, finally.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Speaker John Boehner says House Republicans will not stand in the way. They will allow a vote on a bipartisan deal to end the government shutdown and temporarily raise the debt ceiling. That deal was crafted in the Senate. Both houses of Congress are now expected to approve it sometime tonight. But a lot of people around the globe are still feeling anxious, nervous that the U.S. will at some point default on its debts. So we begin our coverage today with a quick spin around the world to hear how this whole Washington mess is going down in five countries. Ready, steady, go.
I'm Jesse Appel. I'm an intercultural comedian. I live in Beijing, China, and I've been in Beijing for about 2 years. It's definitely all over the newspapers. I mean, it's a big thing for the government here because they own so much of that debt. So they like to publish articles talking about how the U.S. is recklessly endangering the global economy and should really get its ducks in a row. And there's probably a bit of a fair point to that. For the people on the street, I think it's more of a curiosity than anything else. I think that most people that I talk to, they say, hey, how is the government shut down? Like, isn't that the last thing that should be shut down is the government? Wouldn't everything shut down before that? And I don't really have an answer for that. I guess it definitely would be that way here. So I've been trying to work the debt ceiling issue into my comedy as much as possible. I have a joke that I do that I like to bring it out of the blue. And I say, you know, Chinese people always ask me, like, in America, can you make jokes about the government? And I say that actually, no, you can't, because the government itself is a joke.
My name is Annie Murphy. I'm in Lima, Peru. I'm a journalist here, a freelancer. And I've come back and forth between Peru and the U.S. for work for about a decade. It's just like, could this really be happening? I mean, this is a country that went through a really bloody civil war, you know, widespread poverty, just huge real crises. And so they're looking at the U.S. and saying, you guys kind of generated this crisis yourselves. You know, it wasn't like you had guerrillas or dictatorships or something like that. So I think there's this real sense of the U.S. just, you know, kind of being immature.
My name is Brady Kiesling. I've lived in Athens since 2000. I was a former U.S. diplomat. Now I'm a writer. The Greeks are extremely puzzled at what's going on in the United States. Greece is now in its crisis, putting padlocks on lots of museums and archaeological sites and other things of public utility because it can't afford to keep them open. But when a rich, successful country is voluntarily putting padlocks on things, it's crazy to them. They think the whole purpose of government is to keep the public good. If government isn't doing that, it's no government at all.
I'm Bianca Vasquez-Tonis, a journalist in Mumbai, India. I've lived here for 1 year. It sounds like the kind of thing that would happen in a banana republic or a smaller, less important country. My neighbor runs an advertising company, and his clients are, for the most part, here. He has worked for the U.S. government before. It does affect him when the rupee crashes, and you know the rupee took a huge hit in the last few months, and that's affected his life tremendously because he has had plans to send his eldest daughter to university in the United States, and that's no longer going to happen.
And I'm Frank Contreras in Mexico City. I've been a freelance correspondent here since 1996, From here in the Mexican capital, the possible U.S. default and the shutdown that's going on right now strike many people as just kind of absolutely bizarre. They can't even imagine that the world's wealthiest country, the country that Mexico depends on so much for its exports, 80% of exports go to the U.S., that country's, you know, shut down in part and on the brink of falling into default. I have been talking to some economists who are looking at this, and they're seriously concerned. They say that Mexico is heavily invested in U.S. Treasury bonds, and that could have a direct effect on their ability to finance major projects. And this is happening right at a time when Mexico really needs to restart its economy. So they know that if they can't kickstart major infrastructure projects because of the, you know, the problem with U.S. bonds losing their value, and that could happen overnight if this default takes place, economists tell me, then of course, Mexico is going to fall into a really serious situation. And today, for example, the Mexican stock exchange called the Bolsa fell 0.4% in early trading because of news coming from the United States on the possible default. But I think in the end, what people really are talking about is this soccer match that took place last night. Mexico losing once again in its qualifying rounds to head to the World Cup in Brazil, losing 2-1 to Costa Rica, not a very powerful team. And nobody here is very proud of their team. You know, they know Mexico's been playing very weakly, but they also know that the United States won its match against Panama, and that saved Mexico, giving Mexico another chance to try to qualify for the World Cup. And a lot of people here are saying, you know, more than talking about the possible default, they're saying things like they don't even want to see their team in Brazil because it would be just too embarrassing.
Correspondent Frank Contreras with a view from Mexico City ending our shutdown world tour. And don't worry, we'll be hearing more about why Mexican soccer fans are embarrassed by their team in just a few minutes. But let's stay on the fiscal crisis right now. To many outside the U.S., our whole debate about the debt ceiling is just plain confusing. Maybe that's because no one else seems to have one. Here's more on that from The World's Jason Margolis.
When you look at the foreign press online, a lot of stories about the U.S. right now go something like this.
So what is the debt ceiling? Well, in many months, the U.S. government spends more money than it gets in. Like anyone.
That's a BBC video that accompanies its debt ceiling coverage. The video must be hugely helpful for people outside the U.S. who have good reason to be confused.
The debt ceiling is a very strange idea, and I'm not surprised that very few other countries have it.
Lee Branstetter, an economist at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, says the debt ceiling creates a built-in conflict between different laws.
When Congress passes a budget and the president signs it, that creates a set of legal obligations. And what can happen, and what has happened, is that, you know, the budget that Congress passes and the president signs can conflict with this other law called the debt ceiling, which says that the U.S. government can only borrow so much money, right? So this is a very weird situation, and it's kind of gratifying that other countries aren't engaging in this.
Well, most other countries. At least one other nation does have a debt ceiling, Denmark. Lisbeth Petersen is an economist at the Danish National Center for Social Research. I asked her if Denmark ever has problems with its debt ceiling like we've been having.
No, not at all. Not really, no. In Denmark, we never hit the ceiling, you know.
She says the reason Denmark doesn't hit its ceiling is because they set it really high.
You really have to do something stupid to hit the debt ceiling.
In other words, it's kind of an emergency check on Danish lawmakers, not a biannual fight. Petersen also points out that Danes wouldn't go to the brink over a fight over health insurance. They already have universal coverage. This is not to say Danes are profligate spenders with no limits. European Union states have caps on how much money they can spend as a percentage of their economic output. Lee Branstetter says that's a different concept, though, from a debt ceiling. He says the EU spending ceiling was put in place because some member states had a history of high deficits. The guidelines instill a bit of fiscal discipline.
However, lots of EU states have gone well above the ceiling, you know, including the core economies like Germany and France. And they've done so without much in the way of a real penalty. And, you know, the guideline is designed to be flexible so that in difficult economic circumstances, it can be exceeded. So it doesn't create the same kinds of problems in the EU that the debt ceiling creates for us.
So what is Branstetter's solution? Dump the debt ceiling.
because again, you know, essentially what it amounts to is the possibility of this weird situation where the government has two contradictory laws. I just don't think it's a situation that we want to be in. And I don't think that the existence of a debt ceiling has really accomplished anything in terms of imposing fiscal discipline on the United States in the long run.
Perhaps that's another option for members of Congress to consider. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Back to that soccer match Frank Contreras in Mexico City mentioned a few minutes ago. The World's William Troop is following all the nail-biting action as teams from around the globe try to qualify for next year's Soccer World Cup in Brazil. And as you were telling me earlier, William, this is when things kind of get surreal, even wacky, in World Cup soccer in this qualifying phase, which I guess is a good starting point for understanding why Mexicans are so unusually grateful today for the United States. Explain this.
Basically, right now is crunch time for qualifying for next year's World Cup, which will be played in Brazil. And a lot of nations have already made it, have qualified. But some teams are still, you know, really, really trying to squeak in. And one of those teams is Mexico.
And so last night, they weren't the only ones playing. The United States was also playing a qualifying match against Panama. So suddenly you've got these two matches side by side. What happened?
It got crazy. There was Mexico playing Costa Rica and the U.S. playing Panama. And at one point, towards the end of both those matches, which were being played simultaneously, Mexico was losing and so was the United States. And that meant that Panama was going to get the last ticket to the World Cup from the North America Caribbean region. And Mexico was going to be eliminated. Goodbye, go home, watch the World Cup on TV. Instead, in the next few minutes, what happened is that Mexico still lost its game. They really haven't been playing very well. But the U.S. came back, and in the last 90 seconds of play in that game against Panama, they scored a couple goals, came out on top, won. And what do you know? Panama is the one that goes home and watches the World Cup on TV next year. Mexico still has a chance. They are not through yet. They have to play New Zealand in a playoff next month.
Right, and just because Mexico loses, it had enough points and the U.S. winning meant that it could go ahead.
Yeah, and by the way, I should say the U.S. has already qualified, so has Costa Rica and Honduras for the World Cup. Now Mexico has to play that one more playoff.
So that's the story here in our neighborhood, our hemispheric neighborhood, but there's also big World Cup qualifying news in the rest of the world. For example, I saw this tweet from CNN's Christian Amanpour this morning. Once I stood in soccer field turned graveyard in Sarajevo, now Free Bosnia enters World Cup for the first time. Congratulations. So tell us, what happened there?
Yeah, basically the bottom line there is that Bosnia, a country which of course did not exist until sometime in the 90s, has qualified for the World Cup for the first time in its history. And Bosnia is a very small country, not even 4 million people living there. That's been through a lot of war and strife, of course. Now has this amazing reason to celebrate. I mean, the players came back from their game in Lithuania yesterday. They won 1-0 there. Came back to Sarajevo to ride in an open-top bus through the city, people celebrating. It got wild down there.
So that's Bosnia. They get a World Cup bid for the first time. So that's great news for them. There's also some weird little story items from Iceland. What's going on there?
Yeah, another country that has a playoff chance to make it to the World Cup still is Iceland. And they're really psyched because if Iceland makes it to the World Cup, also that would be for the first time in their history, they would become the smallest country ever to qualify to the World Cup. Iceland has, I think, about 300,000 people. The previous record was held by Trinidad and Tobago, which they have more than 1 million people. So that would be quite a record for Iceland.
The World's William Troop keeping us up to date on World Cup qualifying news. And I have to say this, go Iceland! Still ahead, chasing a lowercase b to solve a hate crime against immigrants in New Hampshire. That's on The World from Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Buying a beer in Turkey got more complicated recently. New restrictions went into effect about a month ago. The sale of alcoholic beverages is now banned in Turkey between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. Sales are also prohibited within 100 meters of most schools and mosques. And there's a complete ban on alcohol advertising. Dalia Murtada reports now on how the new rules are impacting the drinks business in Turkey.
Tucked away in the rolling hills of Izmir on Turkey's Aegean coast, men and women harvest the grapes of neat vineyards. It's a young winery run by a young woman, Gaia Özcan.
We are such a new company, such a new wine brand. 2013 was going to be the first year for promoting and launching our wines. And of course, I was planning to do many tastings and events to get in contact with my potential consumers.
If Özcan sounds worried, it's because she is. The country's new alcohol law makes it illegal to advertise or promote alcohol under any circumstances.
Welcome to new space. These are the fermentation tanks.
After being the only girl from her high school to study agricultural engineering in college, Özcan went to San Francisco to get her master's in enology, the science of winemaking. While she was there, she got a lot of questions about how she could produce wine in a Muslim country.
This is a Muslim country, but we are democratic and we are liberal. And, you know, I'm a Muslim, I'm a winemaker, but it's not conflicting. But now I'm finding it's hard to defend my country in the same way as I did like a couple of years ago.
As Özcan's team bottles hundreds of this year's vintage Neef wines, she reflects on what she now cannot do. No wine tastings, no promotions or advertisements in stores, and she may even have to avoid showing wine on her website. Any company found violating the law can be charged anywhere from $2,500 to $250,000. And it isn't just alcohol producers facing a new reality with the promotion ban.
20% of our revenue was constituted by alcohol companies and what we did for them and, you know, the sponsorships.
That's Deniz Huysal, the editor-in-chief of Time Out Istanbul. A magazine about life in the city, Time Out makes a lot of money from alcohol ads and promotions and regularly recommends restaurants, bars, and cocktails.
You can't create anything that's going to enhance the wish to consume more alcohol. I'm not sure how much would entice a person to go and consume. That's pretty broad, you know.
Until they can figure out exactly what could get them into trouble, Time Out Istanbul's English edition has suspended a popular column that recommends Turkish wines from the country's burgeoning boutique industry. This new law doesn't only affect boutique winemakers or entertainment magazines. Some of the biggest companies in Turkey and Europe are affected as well. Rakı is a traditional Turkish liqueur made from anise seed. In this ad, Rakı plays a big part in a night out on the town with friends and family. Yeni Rakı is owned by Diageo, the world's largest producer of spirits. When asked about Turkey's new promotion and advertising ban, a company spokesperson said they're still committed to their business in Turkey. They said net sales have been up 8% so far this year. But it's hard to see how that will continue. Yeni Rakı, an Efes Pilsen, Turkey's largest beer brand, used to sponsor concerts and festivals. Now, their brands can't be visible in public or on TV. When images of alcoholic beverages do show up, they must be blurred, the way Turkey does for cigarettes. And that's exactly the comparison the government is making.
Ve bugün birçok hastalıkların anası...
Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan explained earlier this year that his government is banning the promotion of booze, as it did with the promotion of smoking, to keep people safe and healthy. But Özcan doesn't buy it. She says that there are lots of things dangerous to people's health. But unlike booze, they're not forbidden in Islam.
Like everything, it's not just for alcohol. If you consume something too much, it can harm you. Like fast food, isn't that harmful? It's harmful. It's like all the fats, trans fats and everything. Do they have labels? Do they warn kids about that? Do they have any restrictions on advertisement of McDonald's or Burger King or any kind of things? They don't have.
At this point, Özcan says she feels abandoned by her government, which gave her the license to produce the things she can't talk about anymore. She and the rest of Turkey's alcohol producers will probably have to start looking abroad to sell their products. On the bright side, says Özcan, maybe it's a good thing that Neef wines go global sooner rather than later. For the world, I'm Dalia Mortada, Izmir, Turkey.
So wine doesn't really go well with a cronut, but you didn't need me to tell you that. A cronut, in case you haven't been following that world where fat grams don't matter, is kind of a cross between a croissant and a donut. The cronut was invented in New York, but it's becoming big in London, really big. Here's Russell Newlove.
American-style food has been having a bit of a renaissance in London recently. Burger bars, hot dog restaurants and retro diners have all surged in popularity over the last year, so it's a wonder that the latest American culinary creation took as long as it did to arrive on our shores. Blame Twitter, then, that London is now paralysed by the calorific custard-filled cronut.
really sickly sweet. And they're filled with this cream. There was one that had apple and cinnamon. There was a custard one, I think.
Daniel Goldstein, who writes for London's Time Out magazine, was in New York when she heard about Dominique Ansel's Cronut, a croissant-donut hybrid that has been making headlines and increasing waistlines since they went on sale in the Manhattan-based Chef's Bakery.
When I went down to the bakery, 2 hours before it opened, there was a queue around the corner. And this had been happening for, like, the past month, every single morning, which is nuts.
Danielle admits that a genuine American cronut was a bit too much for her, only managing half. It's not hard to see why. Round, like a donut, but inside filled with many layers of pastry like a croissant. A squeeze of jelly, cream or custard inside too, and then fried and rolled in sugar for good measure, and then topped with a glaze, and some more sugar. A few tweets later, and the cronut craze had spread back to London.
Maybe a week or 2 weeks after I got back, suddenly cronuts had supposedly hit the capital.
I saw on Twitter that people were asking, where can I get a cronut in London? And I was like, that's weird, no one's doing them.
Jennifer Rinkoff runs the Rinkoff Bakery in London's East End. A family bakery of over 100 years and four generations, it has the honour of being the first bakery in the UK to sell cronuts. Although due to some copyright issues with Ansel, Jennifer sells crodos, not cronuts.
I'd heard about this whole thing in America, and I was like, we can make these, they look really simple. Just sort of went into the bakery and trialled and then took off from there.
Pretty soon, other bakeries joined in. Londoners can now tuck into crodos, furnuts, dosants, and they're doing so with gusto. As London's newly appointed critic of all things high calorie, I asked Danielle Goldstein why we appear to be so enamoured with American, cuisine.
It must just be a sort of cultural thing. You know, we already love American TV and music. But I think it's just the sort of obsession with the US, generally.
For The World, I'm Russell Newlove in London.
And you're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, the U.S. citizenship test. You study, 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 you pass it, and then?
Yeah, now I've probably forgotten, like, half of what I studied. It's kind of sad, but that's just the kind of test it is.
Plus, a man is arrested in a New England town accused of harassing African immigrants with graffiti.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Debt ceiling is one of those terms that probably doesn't translate well. Maybe one day it'll wind up on the U.S. citizenship exam. It's already a pretty tough test, but it turns out that nearly everyone who takes the exam passes it, probably because people spend hours in classes memorizing the material, not to mention $600 for the test fee. Critics have called the test arbitrary and unfair, but what's the alternative? As part of our coverage this week on citizenship, Sam Harnett takes a look.
The best way to prepare for the U.S. citizenship test is memorization, memorization, memorization.
What is the highest court in the United States?
The Supreme Court.
How many justices are on the Supreme Court?
Nine.
This prep class in Utica, New York, is like your worst nightmare of an eighth grade history lesson. But it's not junior high. The room is filled with immigrants, and they're preparing for their citizenship exams.
Hey, remember the three branches? What are the three branches?
So the federal agency that creates and administers this test is the USCIS. That's the United States Citizenship and Immigration Service. A few years ago, it spent millions revamping the exam, trying to make it less about memorization. Julie Gluleven doesn't think they succeeded.
It's kind of sad, but that's just the kind of test it is.
Gluleven moved to the U.S. from France in 1998. She passed the citizenship test by cramming the night before.
Yeah, now I've probably forgotten, like, half of what I studied.
But for people not fluent in English, the test is a challenge. Take Amu, a 62-year-old refugee from Burma. I met her in the classroom in Utica, New York, preparing for the test. Her brain, she says, just isn't what it used to be.
I want to get more opportunity in U.S., but I need to try more.
The citizenship test has two parts, an English language section with reading, speaking, and writing, and a civics part with 100 possible questions. Some are easy, like who's the president of the U.S.? Others are tougher, like how many amendments are there? Or this doozy.
The Federalist Papers were written by whom?
Paula Winke is a professor of second language studies at Michigan State University. She says Americans can't even answer questions like this, so it shouldn't be on the exam. Winke's done research to determine if the exam is a good standardized test. Her premise is that the exam should prove that an immigrant's civics knowledge matches that of an average U.S. citizen. But Winke says that's not the case.
I think we've got 10 items that are working really well and 90 that are not.
Winke found that U.S. citizens only perform noticeably better than immigrants on local governance questions, like who's your House representative?
From a test development standpoint, then you start wondering, well, what is this test testing?
Testing is a science. Normally, exam companies release a technical test manual. It's a public document that explains things like how the questions are developed and how the exam is run. Winke says the public expects such transparency for tests like the SATs and GREs. But she says the USCIS doesn't provide it for the citizenship test.
USCIS is now a giant test company, yet they're not behaving like one.
But USCIS spokesperson Daniel Cosgrove says it's a mistake to compare the citizenship test with, say, the SATs. He says immigrants gain valuable knowledge through studying.
The study materials on our Citizenship Resource Center prepare applicants for a life of engaged citizenship, not simply to pass a test.
Recently, the USCIS announced nearly $10 million to fund innovative test prep courses, ones that give applicants context and engage them. But many immigrants say the test is still about memorization. Eric Cohen has a different idea. Offer an option besides the test.
Someone could opt out of taking the test and instead actually take a class.
Cohen is director of the Immigrant Legal Resource Center in San Francisco.
It could be an engaging class, which not only covers U.S. history and government, but also real civics, how to volunteer, how to engage in voting, how to read a proposition, etc.
Practical information. Things, he argues, would really help immigrants engage in life in America, not just facts to memorize.
Why does the flag have 50 stars? Because one star.
Back in Utica, Amu, the refugee from Burma, continues to cram. If she passes the test, she'll be the first person in her family with U.S. citizenship. After that, she'll probably never be asked again who wrote the Federalist Papers. For The World, I'm Sam Harnett, Utica, New York.
So if someone asked you why Ben Franklin is famous, could you come up with the answer? Seems like there's probably more than one right answer to that one. Well, it's just one of the questions on the U.S. citizenship test. We've pulled together a pop quiz from the official test. Try it. I did. And it's harder than I thought, even for multiple choice. You can find it on our website, PRI.org. Tomorrow, we'll hear about some of the obstacles immigrants can face when applying for U.S. citizenship, especially if they're Muslims. It's fair to say life for new arrivals is not easy, but imagine waking up one morning and finding the words, "You are not welcome here, you are proven to be subhumans." Well, for 2 years, anonymous hate messages like that have appeared on the homes of African refugees in Concord, New Hampshire. The graffiti was usually written in black marker and began appearing back in 2011. Local police had no leads, though, but now a man has been arrested. Earlier, I spoke with John Duval, the police chief of Concord. He says the detective in charge of the case found a clue in the graffiti. The letter B looked like a number 6.
We knew that we had unique handwriting, that if we could find something similar, that would be probably our best lead. And the investigator was looking through reports that we had taken in that South End neighborhood, going back a few years, even before the date of these crimes, looking for anything that was similar. And he was hitting dead ends until one report he was looking at had a copy of a gun permit. It was just any old gun permit. But what he noticed is that it was handwritten. And he accessed our files of gun permits, and he started with the letter A and just methodically was just looking at writing, wasn't looking at names or addresses, just looking at letters. And when he got to this individual's gun permit, there was that letter B that looked like a number 6. And then it was like a light came on. He said it was just an absolute match. And then the investigation focused from that point forward.
So the African community that the suspect was allegedly targeting, I mean, how shaken up were they by these writings, this graffiti?
Them waking up to these crimes was significant because they, I mean, they're human beings. They understand what it's like to be targeted. In fact, they fled their countries for a variety of reasons for their own personal safety. In fact, one of the residents had communicated with a friend of the family that back in their country, if they found writings on the wall, that was usually a precursor for being killed. So the messaging for them was that somebody is singling us out. There were children in each of these homes. They were afraid to leave their homes. They were even afraid of playing in their own backyards during the day. And it created a high level of anxiety and fear with the families.
I mean, that narrative you tell of Africans waking up and finding writing on their walls, threatening writing, that would have happened, especially among Rwandans, I imagine.
Exactly. Their fears were steeped with experiences that many, if not all of us in this country, can only imagine with horror. And here they are looking for a place to start over again, to establish their life and bring with them their culture. And they wake up to this type of messaging. And it was quite, I mean, it rocked our community.
I mean, it'll come as a surprise, I think, to a lot of our listeners that Concord, New Hampshire has so many Somalis and Rwandans and Congolese.
Well, combined with other nationalities, we have about 1,500 in the city of Concord. We're a diverse community, but not as diverse as many. But the people in this community appreciate individuals' rights and respecting others' dignity and their culture and what makes them individuals. And I was proud to be the police chief, and I also live in this city, and people came out of the woodwork to express their dissatisfaction with this type of behavior and their resolve to be active about speaking about it, but in a positive way. So it could have turned divisive in many ways, but the community really, really pulled together, expressing positive messaging when talking about these things and how we need to learn more about each other instead of acting on ignorance and bringing presumptions to a conversation that aren't true.
John Duvall, Police Chief of Concord, New Hampshire, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Highly anticipated talks on Iran's disputed nuclear program wrapped up today in Geneva, and they seem to end on a positive note. The White House called the multilateral talks useful, but were there any breakthroughs? Not really. Still, they did agree to meet again in November. Syed Hossein Mousavian is a former nuclear negotiator for the Iranian government. He's currently a research scholar at Princeton. And I asked him why anyone should expect further discussion might produce a genuine agreement.
Iran really means it, and they are ready to make a final deal covering the major concerns of the world powers if the world powers are prepared also to meet the major demands of the Iranians.
If for you the big headline here is that Iran is sincere and for real this time around, why do you think the country just won't open the door to monitors and allow inspection of any suspicious activities related to nukes? I mean, doesn't it make Iran seem like it's got something to hide?
No. Actually, in 2003 to 2005, we took initiative to go for maximum level of transparency. That time I was member of Iranian nuclear negotiation team. The international community, they were asking us to implement additional protocol. We implemented. We gave access to international community, to the IAEA, even to military sites. We did everything. We showed the maximum level of transparency.
Let me ask you this, though, because a lot of skeptics in the U.S. right now are saying the current round of negotiations in Geneva, basically, you know, Iran is simply playing for time, they say, and trying to draw these talks out while they get closer to producing a nuclear weapon.
I mean, this is not really the fact. The fact is, today, the U.S. would have to respect the legitimate rights of Iran for peaceful nuclear technology like other members. But main question remains to me is whether President Obama would be able to deliver sanction relief or not. Without removal of sanctions, there would be no deal. Now the package is on the table.
That was Syed Hossein Mousavian, a former nuclear negotiator for the Iranian government. He's currently a scholar at the Program on Science and Global Security at Princeton. To get a different look now at the prospects for a thaw in U.S.-Iranian negotiations, we turn to David Rode. He's a columnist for Reuters. So we just heard from Professor Mousavian at Princeton that while no concrete statements of progress were made at the close of this first session on Iran's nukes in Geneva, it's still for real, he says. Iran is sincere. I mean, is it hard for you, David, to look at the last few days in Geneva and not see the same old dance?
I was in Washington yesterday and spoke to some people at the State Department. They're hopeful that there could be a breakthrough here, but they're very cautious. And there is a long history here of either delaying tactics or outright deception by the Iranians. So I don't want to discount, you know, the negotiations, but you know, I talked to State Department officials very close to Secretary Kerry, and they said, you know, he is wary as well. He wants to try this, but he knows it could be a delaying tactic.
Well, it was interesting. Secretary of Kerry was not at these talks in Geneva. Did your contacts at the State Department have anything to say about that?
I pushed them. It's a great question. And I said, why isn't he there? Is this a sign that, you know, Kerry doesn't want to get associated too closely with this in case it doesn't work? They said, no. Wendy Sherman, the official that's there, has led nuclear talks in the past, knows all these details. I think Kerry is keeping his distance. I think that they want to see how serious this Iranian proposal is. Today's, you know, announcement of talks in 3 weeks is a positive sign. But, you know, what they made very clear is that there are forms of very intrusive inspections that can work, that can more or less stop the Iranians from potentially building a bomb. The question is, will the Iranians agree to it?
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, too, David. Do you think the current shutdown and debt ceiling crisis affects any of this negotiation with Iran business, or is it just a parallel universe right now?
Oh, I think it definitely affects it. I mean, more broadly, across the State Department, there are senior nominees that Kerry has been trying to get into office that, you know, are waiting to just have hearings in the Senate, and they can't because it's been so consumed first with sort of the Syria crisis and now the debt limit. So I know it's broadly affecting the State Department, you know, beyond financially, just not being able to have senior people confirmed. And it is a distraction. I think it, you know, Secretary Kerry had to fill in for the president across Asia. And I think it is seen as a weakness that the United States' house is completely out of order. The president has to stay in Washington instead of, you know, going out on these trips that were planned for months in advance. So I do think it definitely impacts things.
David Rode, a columnist for Reuters. His latest book is Beyond War, Reimagining American Influence in a New Middle East. David, always good to talk. Thank you.
Thank you.
There are lots of new ways to find the world online. There's our main digital home, PRI.org, or check out our stories on the Flipboard app. It's really cool. Imagine radio stories turn into articles that you can actually flip through like a magazine. And you can also hear all the great voices from the world. It's a terrific way to listen, and it runs on your iPad, iPhone, or Android device. You can find the Flipboard app at flipboard.com/the world. This is The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. 8 months ago, you may remember, a meteor crashed in Russia. It injured hundreds of people. That was in the Ural Mountains in the region of Chelyabinsk. The meteor made headlines around the world after a lot of dashboard video cams captured the space rock's fiery descent and crash. It literally lit up the Russian sky. Well, the meteorite's back in the news. Russian scientists are today trying to weigh a gigantic rock, which they say is a remnant of the Chelyabinsk meteorite. BBC correspondent Oleg Boldarev is in Chelyabinsk. It's been a busy day, I gather, Oleg, at the edge of the lake where this suspected piece of the meteorite was discovered. What's the scene been like?
Well, we were the first on the scene, I must say, but then little by little the camera surrounded the spot on which a large liver and jackliver was standing. The meteorite actually was hanging very near the shore. That's where it was brought yesterday. Basically, as it went in, it pierced at least 2 feet of ice on the 15th of February of this year. And so the scientists sort of had the idea it must be beneath. But it took them a very long while to discover where exactly it is. The bottom of the lake is covered with a very thick layer of sediment. So for a while, they were sort of blinded by this thick layer of mud they were using the sonar. the team of divers were doing this. Finally, they found it, but the early prediction where it might have been were wrong.
So it's been hauled out now, I guess. How big is it? How close did you get to it?
Well, I was standing 2 meters away from it. It was actually broken in 3 pieces as they were lifting it. So there's one very large chunk, the size of, what could be considered a fridge in Europe. In America, the fridges are probably bigger. They immediately hoisted it onto a scale, trying to weigh it. Finally, the weighing mechanism gave up at 570 kilos, 1,140 pounds in U.S.
Right, just broke the scale. So has there been a lot of curiosity from locals there in Chelyabinsk? Are they out along the shore? What are they saying?
This is a very interesting bit. Not too much interest. Back in February when I came here, the local mayor, the mayor of the town, which sits next to the lake, the town of Chebarkul, was telling me very excitedly how he was going to exploit this, how the tourists would come. The tourists were indeed coming back in the winter. But now I just picked up a local newspaper and I'm reading there's a whole conference being called trying to explore the marketing potential of it. And by the sound of it, not much of it actually came out.
I mean, it's kind of curious because when the meteorite hit back in February, eyewitnesses said they felt intense heat from the fireball. Some even thought this was a nuclear attack.
We've spoken to some people. I spoke to a driver who was bringing us to the shore, and he said, you know, he was affected in a very strange way. He felt something big and horrible loomed over him. We spoke to people who were hunting for the bits of the meteorite. They were very excited. They said, you know, something else happened, something beyond just a dreary political or economical news here in Russia. But I'm not sure much of this sentiment remains. And, you know, Russians are being bombarded by so much big news that sometimes they become jaded quite soon.
Yeah, that's some serious jadedness. I mean, this is the largest known natural object to have entered Earth's atmosphere in the past century, so.
Exactly. And the scientists I spoke to said, you know, even if the meteorite they found today was twice as small, 250 kilos, 300 kilos, it would still be the largest stone meteorite ever found in Russia.
BBC correspondent Oleg Boldarev in Chelyabinsk. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I need that. I need it to feel like, you know, when your mother used to take you to the African party. You're my sweetie, my sugar, my baby, my love. With a god in Nigeria. So honey, let me hold you. You know what it is. You know this one, right? Let me love you forever.
Hip hop there from Wale and from music producer and 8-time Beat Battle champion Apple Juice Kid. Did I also mention he teaches at the University of North Carolina? Well, for that and for the next few minutes, Apple Juice Kid goes by his given name, Stephen Levitin. He and his partner in music, Pierce Freelon, have a project called the Beatmaking Lab, which we introduced you to a couple of weeks back. The labs teach students around the globe how to produce hip-hop beats, and they've been telling us about their latest project in Ethiopia. Stephen Levitin joins us now from WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Let me ask you first about your nom de guerre, Apple Juice Kid. Where did that come from?
That came from a trip I took in my junior year in college. I was in Europe busking on the street playing the djembe. And
that's a West African drum.
Yep. I met a friend of mine named Adam Mansbach, who was a new friend and a whole group of musicians over in Europe. And we were wanting stage names for ourselves over there when we were playing on the street. You know, I didn't want to say Steven on the drums. I wanted a cool name, you know. And we were talking about how you could divide the world into two halves according to what you drank as a child. So if you drank apple juice as a child, you were going to have a sweet, easy life. If you drank orange juice as a child, you would have a acidic, difficult life. So I drank apple juice a lot as a kid, so I became Apple Juice Kid.
Lest anybody think that you are just a busker who likes beats and apple juice, let's make sure we know who we're dealing with here. You've produced some of the biggest names in the business, right?
Yeah, so most recently Azalea Banks, which is a new artist out of Harlem that's gotten pretty big over in Europe.
Great new artist.
Camp Lo. I became very good friends with Suede and Chiba from Camp Lo. Did another track for Mos Def, which I co-produced with Ski Beats, and Ski produced part of Jay-Z's first album, Reasonable Doubt.
Now, in addition to the Beatmaking Lab, you've also got this competition that you hold periodically for beatmakers all over the world. They don't have to be in any of your labs. They just have to love making beats. So right now you're using kind of, if we can compare this to Iron Chef, the magic ingredient is actually an Ethiopian instrument called the masinko. Tell us what the masinko is.
The masinko is a very unique instrument that we had never seen before. It's a stringed instrument played with a bow in a really unique scale We also sampled a soccer chant from an Ethiopia versus South Africa soccer football game we went to. So the soccer chant and the masinko are the ingredients for our beat-making challenge to everyone in the world.
Stephen, let's go out today with the winner from the previous competition, Rhythms and Sounds Emanating from Fiji. This is pretty cool. I'm hearing South Pacific percussion underpinning the tune. What is the song and who are the artists here?
The winners from the Fiji challenge were Minimax and DJ EJ. We gave them the challenge of taking this Fijian chant and using the Mumbatone genre, which is a new genre in electronic music.
Well, we'll be checking in with you again next week, Stephen, and with the Beatmaking Lab. Stephen Levitin, a.k.a. Apple Juice Kid, thanks for taking some time to speak with us this week.
Thank you so much.
And Apple Juice Kid and the Beat Lab Project get the last word today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Find more of the world 24/7 at our online home, PRI.org. And thank you for being with us.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org. The Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. Online at RitaAllen.org. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund. And by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.